But let's start with some Godzillas. The United States, the European Union, and Godzillas who'd also say they're much misunderstood also. Transnational corporations, which conservative thinker Francis Fukuyama on yesterday's Late Night Live claimed were risking the future of liberal democracy. The trade relationship between the United States and the European Union is the biggest in the world. Every day, goods and services worth 2 billion euros, that's about 3 billion Aussie dollars, are traded between those continents. A critical treaty between the US and the EU, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, is currently being negotiated. The European Commission is very enthusiastic, arguing that it could result in millions of savings to companies, creating hundreds of thousands of extra jobs and putting more money in the pockets of European citizens. But sceptics are concerned at the increasing influence of transnational corporations within these trade deal processes. And it's relevant to us because a Trans-Pacific partnership is in play, which could supersede our bilateral arrangements with the United States. Among these critics is Susan George. Susan's a political and social scientist and chair of the Transnational Institute based in Amsterdam. Susan's the author of 16 books. Her latest soon to come out is Who Will Win the Class War? Susan is in Australia to present this year's Wheelwright Lecture at Sydney University, and that's tomorrow night. Tonight, if you're listening to the Wednesday, the repeat on Thursday afternoon. And the title is The Growing Power of Illegitimate Authority. Welcome to Late Night Live, Susan.
Thank you so much.
The growing power, and so the illegitimate authority are these transnational
authorities? Yes, largely, and various groups of them, because sometimes they act by themselves, but usually they are acting in concert, and that's perhaps a new danger sign. We always had powerful corporations, but now we have them acting in the transatlantic business dialogue, which led to this treaty that you've just described. They are extremely active in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They have their sectoral groups to deal with every single subject from services to automotive to boats to, and
industry,
industry in general. And they are also forming groups where it's much less recognizable. There we know that it's transnational corporations. But in an outfit like the International Accounting Standards Board, of which Australia is a member, you're not even told that this is a Big Four accounting firm outgrowth. It's people who used to serve with them or have served or who will go back to them and who are making the rules for accounting. Now, that sounds extremely boring, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like
accounting is always
relevant.
Boring, but in fact, we follow the accounting standards. That's what accountants talk about all the time. So it is relevant to us.
Right. Okay.
So let's come.
Because why? But why is it relevant in particular? Because we're never going to get rid of tax havens if we continue to use their rules, because they refuse to consider something called country-by-country reporting, which would oblige the transnationals to say how much they sell, what the profit is that they make, and what the taxes are that they pay in every legal jurisdiction, in every country. But now they're allowed to say Australia and rest of world. So they don't have to tell you that they've got 700 subsidiaries in tax havens, which are allowing them to escape scot-free.
They don't have to declare their cross-border cash flows.
No.
But is that going to... We'll come back to whether that's going to... I want to come back to the accounting standards because that is a fascinating example.
It's an illustration of the way they're forming groups which take over entire sectors of life which used to be the province of Parliament and of democratic process.
So do they have an official membership that's transparent? What's it called now? Transatlantic Business Dialogue, now the Transatlantic Economic Council. Whose membership?
It's changed its name because it's now mature and it has become an official part. The State Department and the Trade Department are really just there to give their seal of approval because this was founded in 1995. These transnationals from both sides of the Atlantic have been working together on every regulation that they want. And it is called a trade treaty, but trade is a very minor part because the tariffs between the United States and Europe are already extremely low. So what are they going to talk about? They're going to talk about regulations. They're going to talk about harmonization, which sounds like a lovely word, but which means pushing down the standards to the lowest common denominator. They're going to talk about investment above all. And an investment is a real can of worms and something to worry about, because you've already had experience in Australia with bilateral investment,
this is the dispute mechanism, which
right.
Australia has now bowed out of, but not in time to prevent Philip Morris suing Australia
yes.
under an obscure Hong Kong arrangement.
Exactly. And if it weren't from Hong Kong, it would be from somewhere else, because they've got subsidiaries everywhere. So what this means is that there's going to be an explosion of litigation. And given the American legal culture, I think it will be the United States corporations that will be suing Australian corporations and European ones in droves, because they will have the opportunity, they have the lawyers, they have the arbitrators, they have the experience. This is a very hard system to sustain. If you're Australia, you can afford it, I suppose, but you probably don't want to afford it.
Although in the bilateral arrangements, we've backed off that. We're not, apparently Australia is not signing up to those dispute mechanisms anymore.
I think they can anymore, but I think they have still to honour what they've already
ones.
Signed. It's not retrospective, unfortunately. It ought to be. But this whole process of a transnational being able to say to a sovereign country and a sovereign people, you owe me, Company X, $3 billion because you have made such and such a political decision. This has happened
in Germany.
In Germany.
With the shutting down nuclear reactors.
With the Vattenfall nuclear company, which was, now Germany has said we're going to decommission our plants. Vattenfall says this is going to cost us $3.7 billion. The suit just started. They haven't been awarded this yet, but that's what they're asking for. And at least 20% of the suits that are brought involve over $100 million. This is not peanuts.
But there is the other side to this story. We'll come back to the transatlantic arrangements in a moment. But there's another side to it. I mean, if you've invested large amounts of money in a nuclear reactor and the government arbitrarily decides to cut it off, surely you've got an entitlement for some recourse in terms of income lost for your investment.
I think you have a right to some recourse. I do not know the details of the case. But what you do not have recourse to normally is to a court outside of the jurisdiction of the countries involved. I think if we had an arbitration system which combined Germany and Sweden with the proper legal representation from each country, okay, fair enough if they decide to do that. But we know that Germany has a perfectly robust legal system. I don't see why this has to be under special courts. To me, that
means... So are they special? Which courts are actually...
They're special courts. They're arbitration tribunals. There are several of them. The best known...
Under whose auspices?
One of them, the best known, is ICSID, which is under the World Bank. Another one is called UNCITRAL, which is under the United Nations. And then there's a variety of others which are less well known and less used. But the ICSID in particular is used by lots of companies, particularly when it is a dispute between a rich country corporation and a poor country, which is a member of the World Bank, necessarily. So what I was going to say is that the whole notion of investor-to-state dispute resolution seems to me to be very arbitrary. It removes from the parliaments, even with states that have a solid judicial system. I'm not talking the Congo here, right? We're talking countries that are mature, that have good judicial systems, where you can get an honest hearing, and we do not need to have tribunals where corporations can say, oh, you just passed a law that infringes on my rights, even if it's to protect consumers, to protect health, to protect the environment, etc., which is also part of the German decision after Fukushima. We can understand that.
You're listening to Late Night Live. I'm talking to Susan George, who runs the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam, and she's here in Australia to give a lecture at the Wheelwright Centre, the Wheelwright Lecture tomorrow night or tonight, if you listen to the repeat, called The Growing Power of Illegitimate Authority at Sydney University. Susan, in your very seat last night on Late Night Live was Francis Fukuyama, with whom you would share not many politics. Your former
that's for sure.
Neoconservative. Well, he wouldn't call himself neoconservative
no,
now.
Not anymore.
But saying very similar things
oh, really?
In terms of the future of democracy, that We are under threat from globalized industry and exactly what you're saying now, which is the lobbying about regulation and reducing regulation to give them more globalized power. And his argument was, which we won't get into now, that that was threatening the integrity, if you like, of the middle class. And
the middle class, the underclass, the upper class, everybody.
So do you feel a bit uncomfortable sharing a rostrum with Francis Fukuyama?
No, because he's been changing. You know, this is a guy who said the end of history. I don't think we've ever been so knee-deep in history as we are right now.
I asked you a question earlier about who are how do you qualify to become a member of the Transatlantic Economic Council? Have you got to be turning over so many billion dollars a year
The guy who heads it, a member, you're invited. You're usually a member of Business Europe or the European Roundtable of Industrialists, which was invented in 1983. The guy who's head of Volvo at the time said, we need a group like this. So then he invited some buddies. They invited other buddies. Now there's 50-some of them. And as Peter...
So they're big. They're not small to medium enterprises.
As Peter Sutherland said, well, this is more than a lobby group. This is a group of people who have access directly to government at the highest level. He's telling it like it is. Peter Sutherland, for those who don't know, was a former European commissioner, but also president of Goldman Sachs later on, and has had various responsibilities. He knows what he's talking about, and he's one of those people who can go to government at the highest level. Same thing on the side of the other side of the Atlantic. It's been an American group which has been hand-picked, but they co-opt each other. I think that's probably the way it happens.
And of course, the criticism in the United States is that they move in and out of government.
Yeah, it's what I call the Davos class. These are people who meet every January in Davos. They all know each other. They say, well, Joe would be good. Norman would be great. You know, we want Norman on our council.
As long as you get the skiing in, I'm fine. Mm. So, Susan, let's go back to this transatlantic investment agreement. And in fact, what they've boasted about.
And it's also for the Trans-Pacific. I want to make that clear because our audience is Australian.
And in fact, one of the sticking points at the moment is in fact lobbying from the tobacco industry to the United States government about harmonising policies on tobacco, and that's been a major issue. But and in fact, they're boasting. They're told that the Economic Council, the Transnational Economic Council, is actually boasting that they've got a seat at the table in this for the first time. They're influencing European Union policy.
Well, the tobacco industry has been influencing policy from day one. They prevented legislation in the United States for many years because they were able to create doubt. That's the tactic of the climate skeptics, of the tobacco industry, of the pharmaceutical industry. It's the tactic that they use. They create doubt, and then they can delay legislation. They can't always stop it.
Is there no role at all for business at the table? Because some would argue that if you actually have business at the table, you could potentially get much more economically efficient agreements without unnecessary regulation, and therefore that would benefit an economy.
Depends on how you define efficiency, I think. If efficiency is having lowest common denominator, that means you're wiping out years of struggle to get better health regulations, better protection for consumers, for households, for let's take the banks. The banks are not under any kind of real supervision now. I think this is extremely dangerous. One of the examples I'll give in the Wheelwright lecture is to explain that there are now 50 the most interconnected companies in the world. This is not me talking. This is three complexity theory mathematicians who've done a fantastic job. 50 extremely interconnected companies. They all own bits of each other. These are what they make up what the mathematicians call the knife edge property, because if something goes wrong in one of them, the whole set of dominoes is lined up and can go and just fall. Now, this is very dangerous because of those 50 companies, 48 are financial, mostly US, British, and other northern companies.
Well documented. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is not a conspiracy.
No,
this is well documented.
I'm sorry. You know, these people have mapped a database of 43,000 corporations.
So this is the classic too big to fail.
They've been able to reduce that to who owns who and what. And their conclusion is 147 companies are extremely interconnected and own 40% of the global economy. And of those, 50 are so, and they're mostly financial, as I just said. And of those, if they fail, it's going to be Lehman Brothers multiplied by I don't know how much. It's going to be really devastating. Now, if that does affect every single person on this planet, because if you have savings, if you have insurance, if you have a job, if you have a pension, all of that, if there's a huge banking crisis because something goes wrong in one of these companies and it really is another fall of the dominoes, as we saw in 2007-08, we're really in good shape.
So what is the Transatlantic Economic Council bringing to the table for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership? And as you say, perhaps in parallel with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, that worries you so much. What elements are they bringing to the table that you find concerning?
First of all, the Transatlantic Economic Council is just a recent name change for what was always called the Transatlantic Business Dialogue. So it's the same corporations, it's the same pursuit. It's headed by a guy whose background is in public relations, which says something about what they're going to do. But in fact, I think most of their work has already been done. Now, we do not have everything on the web. The documents are pretty much secret. The process is secret. And we've had one leak from this, and there's also one official document where the European Union says what it is that they want. And there's some rhetorical flourishes in there saying, of course, we're going to protect health and education and culture and da da da. But I don't think that they're going to do anything much that is new. I think this is the Transatlantic Business Dialogue, which simply continues under another name, and so now it's become official with both sides represented in it. So they have a European board and members.
So it's the same sort of things you hear in bilateral arrangements, extending patents for pharmaceuticals?
All of that's going to be part of it. Genetically modified seeds will be part of it. All pharmaceuticals will be part of it. Finance, because it's a service, will be part of it. I mean, getting regulations, what they have done is to set ceilings on regulations, not floors. So governments are no longer going to be free to say, we need better regulations here or there. But now we've signed this thing, we're in this thing, and we do not have the right to improve our own regulations.
And
this
because
is
it
what
involves,
is so dangerous.
Which is the concern about the World Trade Agreement when it actually moves to services. Once it moves into services, you're talking about opening up your health market, your education market,
exactly.
And others.
Yes, exactly. Well,
but it cuts both.
I was in a campaign against the GATS for several years. Actually, we won because the thing is deadlocked, and we got, in France, 800 different communities, towns, cities, regions, to sign the pledge that they were. It wasn't true. It was symbolic, but they said we are outside. We are GATS-free zones. We don't want this agreement. And we had 1,500 in Europe as well.
But
it was a very dangerous agreement, but it's not gone through. So that's why they started doing the bilaterals, and that's why they're now doing these huge agreements, which will take in, with Trans-Pacific and Transatlantic, that will take in 80% of the world economy.
And, of course, it's easy to imagine that in a kind of stereotypical way, that Americans are behind it. Americans aren't necessarily behind it. I mean, American farmers don't like it.
Well, that depends who. Farmers maybe not. Agribusiness loves it. Agribusiness loves it because they will get all kinds of possibilities that they didn't have before. They will get new capacity to introduce GMOs. They'll get... They will be okay. Agribusiness will be happy.
Given the move... is this a train that's unstoppable? You've got globalization, you've got lower borders, you've got international trade, lower tariffs, prices that we can start to afford in many countries of goods and services. What's going to stop this or hold it back or modify it?
I think that it is possible to stop the more egregious parts of it. Let's put it that way. I'm not against improving tariff practices or making customs simpler, or nobody's against that sort of thing. What people are against is this capacity to allow the transnationals to become the legislature and the judiciary. This just doesn't wash.
So your argument is that even if you believe in free trade, this is anti-competitive.
I think so. I think it will encourage the largest, because small and medium enterprise is really almost completely out of this. It's really the big players. The big players will have a total access. If you're in a community and you want to get a new municipal building built, you have to make that offer internationally with your trade partners. That's what it's about. It's about penetration by transnationals into every aspect of the country's life, except the army, the church, and a few.
So what's a government to do? They want foreign investment. They want competitive markets internally. They want employment. And they feel hamstrung.
Well, you can say that you will allow investment, you will welcome investment under certain conditions, but you will not welcome investor to state dispute resolutions. You cannot sue me, sovereign government, because I pass a new law. That's my right and my duty to my citizens. You can offer, there's been huge international investment without these agreements. This has not deterred anybody who saw a good opportunity in another country. I think that's a false argument.
Now, I promised the listener I'd come back to these accounting standards.
Yes.
Is this an entirely independent, this International Accounting Standards Board, is this an entirely independent organization?
Well, it's sold as one, but where do the people who are on its board come from? They come from the big four accounting firms, KPMG, Pricewaterhouse, Deloitte, Ernst & Young. And I rang them up because I was looking to see would they accept country-by-country reporting systems. And all I got back was something I'd already found on the web myself, which was that they said, we've had a couple of requests to look at country-by-country, but we have no plans to investigate this matter
so
now.
So despite the fact that Obama administration wanted it, the Cameron government wants it in the UK.
Well, they say they wanted it, but who influences them really when they're not on television?
So it's rhetoric without action.
Well, I don't know, except you can see actions are, again, speaking louder than words. I'm not in the cabinet. I have no idea, but it's certainly clear that they are governing of, by, and for the corporations. This is a disappointment in the case of Obama, for me anyway, but we learned that rather quickly.
Now, multinationals would say, if you look at the developing world, we might have been bad in the past, but we've come to realize we have a social responsibility, and we're actually delivering social services in poor countries that either would not be delivered or have been delivered poorly by NGOs, and we're actually being good corporate citizens in these countries.
Well, I'm not saying that every corporation is rotten to the core. That is not my argument. But once I said on a program that I thought corporate responsibility meant first of all and foremost paying your taxes, and the man sitting next to me said, oh, it's my job to make sure that my clients pay the lowest taxes possible. He was a lawyer. So, I mean, is good corporate citizenship paying your taxes when you ought to? Then you ought to welcome the demise of tax havens, because country by country reporting is a way to avoid them.
Susan, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I must ask you about your new book, which is going to go onto your website, How to Win the Class War.
Yes, well,
you've got 2 minutes to tell me what's in the book.
Well, that was fun to write. It's what I call a factual fiction. I invent this sort of
sounds like a transnational corporation talking.
Exactly. I invent a super committee, which all comes from the Davos class. There's lots of my friends from the transnationals there, and they are writing a report for very shady commissioners. We don't know who
this is. The Lugano report.
Well, it's number two Lugano report, and we don't know who those commissioners are either. But the question is, after this crash that we had in 2008, how can we make global capitalism invulnerable? What do we do? So the report is to tell them how and to say, well, you've already succeeded pretty well because there's more financial transactions and no tax. There's more capacity for you to avoid taxes. There was noise about tax havens, but there isn't any more. There are more rich individuals, and the rich individuals have a far higher fortune than they had in 2008, and so on and on. You've already won quite a lot. So just keep going in this way. However, you have to pay lip service to some human rights. We don't want anybody tortured. We don't want anybody put in jail. We want things done by committees like the International Accounting Standards Board. And that's the way you keep it quiet. You keep citizens from understanding what's going on, and your life is golden.
We'll look forward to it. Susan George, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us
on
Late Night Live.
Me.
Now, you can hear Susan George's lecture tomorrow night at Sydney University. That's if you're listening to the original live broadcast of Late Night Live. And it's at Sydney University. It starts at 6 p.m. at the Eastern Avenue Auditorium in Camperdown Campus. It's free and no bookings are required. Coming up here on Late Night Live, some other big beasts who, like transnational corporations, as I said earlier, would say that they are also grossly misunderstood.